closing it, please. It's kind of distracting up at the front, actually, seeing people sort of surfing away during a lecture. So, okay. We ready to roll? So last time I was talking about calculating the Euclidean action of Schwarzschild and pointed out that because the Ricci scalar vanishes, the action is a pure boundary term. And I sort of sketched out what we would have to do, that we would have to look at, sort of put a boundary at some finite R, calculate what the boundary term was, and then I hinted we were going to have to do a subtraction. Okay, so Schwarzschild action is a pure boundary term. And we had shown last time that the correct boundary term to take from the Einstein-Hilbert action was the extrinsic curvature. So what we have to do, we've got our Euclidean solution here, where this is the tau, that's the R, and we've got an S2 sitting over the whole space. So the radius of this S2, let's say, if this is R equals R, is R. So it has area 4 pi R squared. And then, of course, tau has periodicity beta, which was 1 over 8 pi gm, as we calculated. So what we need to do is we've got to find k. So remember, k is just the divergence of a normal vector of the surface. Remember, kb was the projection of grad a and b onto the surface. So we just need to know what the normal vector is to this surface here. But since the surface is just some constant r, that tells us that the normal vector, we'll start off by saying it's got to be proportional to d by dr, and then we want it to have unit length, and so since the component, the RR component of the metric is 1 over 1 minus 2gm on R, we need to put the square root of 1 minus 2gm on R in there. So that makes that normal have length 1. So now what we do is we simply take the divergence of this normal, and that should give us the extrinsic curvature of that surface, and then we'll evaluate it at some large R and see what happens when we put that in the integral. So we look in at evaluating the extrinsic curvature. Then I'm using that expression for the divergence using the square root of the metric. So here, the only non-zero component of n is the r component. And so this is just going to be 1 over r squared dr r squared root 1 minus 2gm on r. So I've just put in what nr is. So I get a 2 over r times root 1 minus 2gm on r. Yes?
Unity?
That's exactly what I've done there.
Is it?
Yeah. That was why I put in that square root.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
So I simply got two pieces here. So the first term is its leading order is 1 over R, and the second term, which comes from the metric, is 1 over R squared. So if I evaluate this at very large R, then I can expand my square root, simply do a Taylor expansion. So that gives me, to leading order, what my extrinsic curvature is. So now I want to put it in this metric here on the boundary. So on my boundary, and I'll write it down explicitly because this actually is something that comes in with the subtraction that's kind of not obvious the first time you meet it. So on my boundary, the metric has the sort of S2 bit of it is what you would expect, because the capital R is measuring the area of the two-sphere. But I just want to draw your attention, just to note this bit here, right? The fact that tau, it's not just 1 times d tau squared, okay? It's a little bit less. So what that means is that d3x, in this case, is going to be r squared sine theta root 1 minus 2gm on r d tau d theta d phi. So that's our root gx. Oops. And so since nothing here really is sort of dependent on tau, theta, or phi, we just get a 4 pi beta as being our, you know, integral over the theta phi gives us 4 pi, the beta from the tau, and then I've got r squared into 1 minus gm on r, again plus order, plus higher order terms. So to get my integral, I'm simply going to combine these things together. So pulling all this together, so when I multiply these two brackets together, I get 2 over r, and then I get minus 3gm on r squared. And so overall, if I simply evaluate this action here, then I'm going to get something which is divergent. I have this linear divergence in R. Okay? So this bare calculation of K has given me something divergent. So what that's telling us is we probably have to do a background subtraction. So let's just have a quick look at what would happen if we try to compute the action for flat space. So if I just look up here, what's going to change if I set m to 0, okay? So if I put m to 0 here to calculate k, then I see there's no square root 1 minus 2gm on R there. So there's none, this second term goes, this is just 1. And so this goes to 2 over R in flat space. But that 2 over R term was precisely what was giving you the divergence over here. So, in other words, if you do a computation of the action of flat space, you're still getting a divergence. So that's telling you you have to subtract off flat space. So we now know k is 2 over r in flat space. So what we have to do is simply subtract that off from the action that we've just calculated on the left. But it's not quite subtracting off this 2r term. And the reason is, if you want to do a subtraction, what you have to do is compare like with like. So you have to compare two spacetimes with the same boundary. So in other words, here we've got the... I'll draw it over here. Maybe it's probably less confusing. Here we've got the black hole geometry. And what we're doing is we're saying that we're subtracting it off from pure flat space, which is just the cylinder. But they both have to have the same periodicity. We have to have the same geometry on the on this surface here. So this boundary has to be the same. So since this tau coordinate was not quite proper time, or, you know, the proper distance around the tau direction, what we have to do is we have to take a cylinder in which the tau coordinate also has the same 1 minus 2gm on R factor in the distance. So we have to have like with like. If our delta tau is beta, our g tau tau has to be the same. So what we're actually doing here is we're taking root g d3x is unchanged, okay? So our background we get our 4 pi beta again from the integration over the angles. And we've got again r squared into 1 minus gm on r. And then we times that by 2 over r, which is the flat space k. So you can see this is 4 pi beta into 2r minus 2gm. So in other words, integral root g k minus k naught. Okay, now the only thing I've noticed since I've gone through this is what I've actually done here. When I put n proportional to d by dr, I was taking an outward pointing normal, so I've actually taken the wrong normal. So if I want to have the real action, I've actually got to put a minus sign in front of that. Okay, so that is the action of the Schwarzschild solution. And it is finite and positive with the right sign. Okay, so just a small subtlety which is... I'll just note, and it probably isn't something that you'll have to worry about most of the time, but note that when we've calculated that action, we really got beta m. We didn't get m squared, we didn't get beta squared, right? Even though we know they're related, but, you know, for Schwarzschild. So it's just a point to note that although in Schwarzschild there's this precise relation, there are times when maybe the mass and the periodicity have just slightly a different relation, and the Euclidean action really is dependent on each of those different variables separately, an ADM mass and the periodicity of Euclidean time. So although they do have some interrelation, it's not, it's best to, you know, in terms of actual variables, to keep them separate. Okay, so to get entropy, so in this case, there's one of the beta, isn't it? We see by looking at log z, log z is beta m on 2, minus beta m on 2, here's one minus sign. So this is just a half beta squared dm by d beta. Got myself mixed up with beta, haven't I? It's the temperature that's 1 over 8 pi gm, and beta's 1 over temperature. Sorry. Am I getting myself all mixed up with 8 pi g's? Right. Okay, so I've obviously got some... So beta's 1 over t, so t would... Well, t is definitely... this is a Monday morning, isn't it? I can see. T is 1 over 8 pi gm. So beta is 8 pi gm. Right. Have a feeling everything's going to come unraveled at the last moment, I think. Okay, so dm by d beta is simply 8 pi g, and so this is therefore Peter over 8 pint. That's what I've got myself. Right, I think I've just reversed the two in my mind somehow. Right, so I... Yes. So, hopefully I'm not missing any twos, yes? In here, okay, let's stop and think about this, since I'm in one of my... On two, yes. So that would be m squared if you replace beta, yeah? So here, what I've done is I've taken minus log to give me beta m on 2, divide by beta, so I get m on 2, so there's the half. M is just beta on 8 pi g, so dm d beta is 1 over 8 pi g. So at this point, we've just got two betas. But then what I want to do is to put it back in terms of m, because what I want to do is to take this here and say that it is 2gm squared, which I know is the radius of the black hole squared. And then that would be over g, so that the factors of g are the same. That's my m squared. Here's a 4. So that's basically taking care of the factors of, you know, 2, but what I really want is a 4 pi on the top, so I have to put a 4 on the bottom there. And so this is just 4 pi r squared. This is just the area of the event horizon over 4g. So there are no extra factors of m if you track it through. And so if you wanted to also put in your C's and H bars, that would be what you would get. So it's very, very big. So this is what, for a very long time, and I suppose as far as the Schwarzschild solution is concerned, is still considered to be a huge problem, because you have a very large entropy for the black hole, which suggests a large number of internal microstates, and yet if you try and look at the black hole and say what numbers can you characterize the black hole by, you still end up with just electric charge, mass, and angular momentum. If you try and put any extra information on the black hole, typically, you can't. So the only exceptions are things like this cosmic string, but then that comes all the way out and goes to infinity anyway, so it's not really asymptotically flat or empty. Or certain unstable solutions where you can, under some circumstances, put a little bit of dressing outside the black hole, non-abelian gauge fields. So the black hole itself does not seem to have, in classical gravity, doesn't seem to have a large number of microstates, nor even in semi-classical gravity when you try and put fields, quantum fields, around it. So this is definitely one of those sort of problems. You've heard the rules of the game are you've taken a classical background, you've taken quantum fields, so this is sometimes called semi-classical, and then you have this description in which black holes radiate, have huge entropy, but there's nothing left to actually label those states. So there's nothing left to tell you what this entropy is coming from. Even worse, so remember T is proportional to 1 over M for the Schwarzschild black hole. So that means that as a black hole radiates, they lose mass. So T increases. So they radiate even faster. And so you get this runaway effect with the black hole evaporating. So again, this set of assumptions of a classical background, quantum fields, is saying that the black hole is going to radiate, it's going to go ever faster, and it drives it towards a situation where it's no longer sensible to look at this particular approximation, because when the black hole is very small, it's sort of Planck size, there's no way that you can reasonably expect to use an approximation like that. So it's one of these situations where there's what you'd call an inconsistency. It's not an internally consistent picture to try and do this field theory on a classical background. But it's the best we've got, particularly if we're dealing with, you know, non-supersymmetric, just bog standard black holes in our universe. And so this is what, well, sometimes is called a black hole information problem. The fact that you can make up a black hole out of some very complex quantum state, but what you get back out is thermal radiation, which is like vanilla. So where is the information gone? So this is one of these interesting problems in sort of black hole physics, quantum black hole physics. So you should read more about it as a recommendation. So I wanted to use this discussion of black holes to start introducing higher dimensions and black holes in higher dimensions. So before I actually go to do higher dimensions properly, in the sense of trying to derive different ways of taking so-called Kaluza-Klein compactification, different ways in which we get a four-dimensional universe from higher dimensions, I wanted to just discuss a bit about black holes in higher dimensions, because it's one way of looking at what can change when you have more dimensions. So I'm wondering if in a tutorial, maybe? I don't know. Carlos just, no, it's Monday morning. So either in a tutorial or in a set of extra questions, one of the questions is to derive a metric of a higher dimensional black hole. So when we derive the Schwarzschild, you know, we derive the spherically symmetric metric, we derive the curvature, the connection one forms, I made a comment then about what changed if you had a cosmological constant, if maybe it wasn't a round hole but a black plane or maybe even a black hyperboloid, and also what happened when you added extra dimensions. So this is basically going to be talking about this. So what happens is if you're, oops, I can't count. If you're in D dimensions, then all that happens is you go from the 1 over R, which is of course the Newtonian potential in three space dimensions, 1 over r is what gives you the Green's function of the Laplacian. And it's in higher dimensions, it's simply 1 over r to the d minus 3. So it's a very straightforward generalization of the four-dimensional black hole. And so you actually... No, they haven't had Malcolm yet, have they? Well, so the people who looked at, and I'll be writing some of their solutions later as well, really were the first to try and categorize black holes in higher dimensions, were Rob Myers here at Perimeter and Malcolm Perry, who will... it's not a proper course, is it? It's a sort of extra series.
Yeah, mini course,
yeah. So anyway, so at least people that you know. I've taken the simplest example here where there's no charge and no rotation because I've just been talking about Schwarzschild. So this is, rather than write a mass here, I've put it at R plus. So we've got, exactly like Schwarzschild, we've got a horizon at R plus, and it's now a D minus 2 sphere. So it's a sort of obvious generalization of Schwarzschild. And then we can relate the mass to that horizon size. So it's a completely non-obvious, until you think about it at least, relation. So D minus 2 or D minus 3. Okay. So the R plus parameter is related to the mass, but normally, so in Schwarzschild, it would be R plus on R. R plus is 2gm. So in higher dimensions, this leading order fall off is always proportional to the mass, but the constant of proportionality is related to the area of the two spheres. So that's what defines the mass. The mass is always like the leading order fall off of 1 over r to something, yes.
Is that
G, the five-dimensional? This is the d-dimensional Newton's constant. So it's very true, now that's a good point, because now that we're sort of venturing out into higher dimensions, typically if I want to emphasize something as four-dimensional, I will say... it's Gn. So typically, okay? So that's, but in any number of dimensions, you've still got the Einstein-Hilbert action being 1 over 16 pi g. So this 16 pi g there is in some sense coming from that Einstein-Hilbert action, so. So, what you may also see is that instead of 1 over 16 pi g, you might see m squared or possibly m squared over 2, depending on sort of conventions. But either way, not 2, it's d minus 2. So m is the Planck mass. And so what this is telling you is that Newton's constant, so to speak, has different dimensionality in different numbers of dimensions. So in units where h bar and c are 1, g has dimensions l squared in 4 dimensions, l cubed in 5 dimensions, l to the 4th in 6 dimensions, and so on. So it's a dimension-full constant. And so the fact that, you know... length is 1 over mass as a dimension when h bar and c are 1, so that's why this is an m to some dimension full dimension-dependent power. Yes, so the Ricci scalar is just the second derivative of the metric, so it's 1 over L squared. That's always true. So, but then you're integrating d dx, right? So you're adding a length for each dimension. So that's kind of why. So just like with the Schwarzschild, we can go through doing that same computation, finding the temperature, finding the the action, and finding the entropy. And so what changes if we again Euclideanize? So once again, we can do the same process of redefining our R coordinate and then computing what the periodicity of tau has to be to give us two, you know, a regular space at R plus. So if we set rho squared is 4 over V primed of R plus times R minus R plus, then 2 rho d rho is going to be 4 dr over V prime. So, hopefully, d rho squared is going to equal 16 dr squared over 4 rho squared V prime plus. So, that rho squared times V prime plus is 4. Now, should I have had prime plus squared? Rho squared times V prime plus over 4 is R minus R plus. So this is the R squared over R minus R plus V prime plus, which is, to leave in order, the right expression. So that's our right coordinate. And then when we look at what d tau squared is, we've got this is r minus r plus v prime plus d tau squared is then going to be rho squared v plus prime squared over 4 d tau squared. So this tells us that the periodicity of tau is 2 pi times 2 over V plus prime. So, so in other words, our temperature, which is 1 over the periodicity of tau, so these black holes also have a finite temperature, and they will also have an entropy, so we can go through the same sort of calculation. So what changes? So we've got the same normal. We're going to have 1 over r to the d minus 2 now instead of 1 over r squared for the spheres. and then that's our root of 1 over GRR. So the 2 over R becomes a D minus 2 over R. And then when we take a derivative of this term here, pulling up a D minus 3 over 2. So if I expand this out like I did before, then I look at what I've got in terms of the 1 over, you know, R plus over R to the D minus 3. Here I've got D minus 2 on 2, and over here I've got D minus 3 on 2. So D minus D minus 2 plus D minus 3 should be minus 1 over 2R. I've already got the minus sign. Okie doke. And similarly, if it was the background, this term wouldn't be here. So now if I take my area, which is now going to be the integral of, well, basically the integral over the unit D minus 2 sphere times the integral over tau, and then I've got R to the D minus 2, 1 minus R plus on R to the D minus 3, the 1/2. So, and then I pull in this thing. Then, again, I'm going to expand this out here. So this is 1 minus 1/2 R plus on R to the D minus 3. And the whole thing gives me the area of the D minus 2 sphere from the angular integral, the beta from the tau integral, and then I have to multiply this lot together. If I manage to do it right, it's probably going to be met. So the first piece is easy. It gives me D minus 2 on R. Then I'm going to have plus D minus 2 over 2 plus. Oh, Okay, so the first thing you'll notice is that the divergence here is worse because you've got, you know, the area of the sphere is even bigger. So that's what we get for the basic action. And then, of course, we've got to subtract off the flat space part. And the flat space part would simply just not have this term here. So I naught, if you like, is going to be the same thing, almost the same thing. Except, as I said, we don't have this half term here. It's not there at all. So when I subtract these two, the leading order divergence is going to cancel. Then this d minus 2 will basically go with that one there. And so all you're left with is this last term. But if you remember, I said that AD minus 2 was simply proportion times R plus to the D minus 3 is proportional to the mass. So this is 16 pi GM over D minus 2, beta over 2. Got my 8 pi g. Factor in the action. Knew something was going there. So, in fact, despite the sort of having to track through all those extra factors of d, the calculation went through really very similarly. I'm sorry I had to concentrate there, but I knew if I didn't, I'd probably drop minus signs and factors of 2 all over the place. But you can see this, obviously, if d is 4, it reduces to what we just calculated. So that's you know, it's good news. But it's saying that, you know, this Schwarzschild-type solution, you can see how things, properties, when you add extra dimensions, there's the only thing that changes is a few numbers here and there. The actual qualitative results are all essentially exactly the same, and it's just a few numerical factors. And so once again, if you look at entropy, then you find out that, again, entropy is 1 over 4 g times the area of the black hole. So this is taking a familiar, rather simple solution and just tweaking it a little bit. We've added extra dimensions, but we've done it in a very straightforward way. So what other solutions can we get? I just want to give a couple of examples. Well, since I mentioned Myers and Perry before when I wrote down this higher dimensional black hole solution, I think I ought to just at least give you an example of a Myers-Perry solution. I mean, what they did was, they looked at it in full generality, but I don't really want to write down the most general metric. So what they've done, Myers and Perry, is to add rotation. So this is a true vacuum solution. There's no fields outside the black hole. So you're going to recognize this because I've chosen it deliberately to look familiar. Oh, don't mean 2 GMR. So this is very familiar from the point of view of the Kerr solution, and what this is a black hole that's just rotating in a single plane. So once you've got more than 3 space dimensions, I think we were saying this or discussing this before, you can then split your dimensions up into pairs. So in each of these, so you can think of it as being sort of sets of planes, and each of these planes can have a rotation within it. So it's like saying that within your general SO D minus 2 rotational group, you've got all these different copies of U1 that you can simultaneously, quite independently, excite. So there's this sort of U1 to the N, which where N is less than or equal to D minus 2 over 2. There's this diagonal subgroup of the rotational group in higher dimensions. So this is the simplest possible Myers-Perry solution, but I just wanted to sort of get a flavor of what you can do. You can have, all sorts of different types of rotation where you excite all these different degrees of freedom. So that's already giving you a clue that there's more possibilities in higher dimensions. And so without any sort of statement or proof, I just want to kind of draw a few pictures to give some examples of what else can happen in higher dimensions. So there's also something called a black string, or more generally a brain, which is some extended object. So in 5 dimensions, and what this does is in vacuum 5-dimensional Einstein gravity, you take the 4-dimensional solution, so this is your black hole, and then you've simply extended it completely uniformly in a 5th dimension. So it's a completely uniform extension of the Schwarzschild solution. This thing here has nothing multiplying it, and it doesn't obviously feed in because this is a 4-dimensional space. And in fact, this is also true any Ricci flat, 4D metric, is a solution to vacuum Einstein equations in 4 plus n dimensions, where you simply add, you sort of take a dy n squared. You simply add a flat perpendicular metric. And so this is a completely regular solution. It's just the way the Einstein, the Riemann and Ricci split up. They sort of, you know, you see when you go through this computation with the connection one forms, how it sort of splits, if you can split your space. Then, so in other words, horizons in higher dimensions don't seem to have to be spherical. So the black ring, for example, is something which has a spinning ring. So that's another example of a black hole. So in other words, you could have Myers-Perry, or you could have one of these rings. Now, just this actually is related to the C metric that we looked at last week, sort of a higher dimensional cousin of it. And then, believe it or not, you can actually get solutions that look like this, where these are horizons. So as soon as you go up, and this is just even, you know, small number of extra dimensions, as soon as you add extra dimensions, the types of solution that you can get start to become quite exotic. And then there are even more. You can take black Saturns and spin them up, and then you start, you know, getting sequences of sort of planets, rings, and all sorts. So, even just without adding any extra fields at all and just adding extra dimensions, you start getting a lot more sorts of solution. However, they're not actually all stable. So this is sort of another theme. But nonetheless, just even the fact that they exist is something which is qualitatively different from four dimensions. So this is going to be the theme for this week, is that we're going to look at higher dimensions in gravity and have a bit of a look at what new things can happen when you've got more dimensions. And also, try and talk a little bit about sort of what you can get, because of course string theory has more than four dimensions generically, so we'll also be trying to talk a little bit about what sort of solutions you can get in string theory. Okay. Any questions?
Delta tau equals beta.
Sorry?
Delta tau equals beta. Where does that come from? We did it the last time, right?
Yeah, I think so. So it's just a definition. Beta is the periodicity of the Euclidean time.
Yeah, it also happens to be the beta from thermodynamics, right?
Yes, that's right. So I asked, I think when I introduced this, I derived the periodicity of Euclidean time. That was where I just had to say, you just had to buy into that part, that, you know, when you did quantum field theory at finite temperature, that was equivalent to doing field theory with a periodic Euclidean time. So I was simply saying, you know, buy into it.
The first part of the periodicity is second measurement.
Is this the same thing?
Yeah, it's exactly the same thing.
Mm. So. The reason it's a cheat here is because usually the periodic time formulation is when you're in thermal equilibrium. Yeah. And so technically we're not, because these black holes have this runaway tendency that once they start evaporating, they evaporate till they disappear. So they're not really in thermal equilibrium. So it's sort of yet again another indication of this uneasy pairing of this, of the, you know, something classical and something inherently quantum mechanical.
Question.
Sorry, I shouldn't make that noise.
Well, the rest of the week going into higher dimensions. Yeah, like the three dimensions then. So.
Oh right.
Can you get back up to three dimensions?
Okay.
It looks like you could just extend that to four dimensions.
Okay. So no, what? He's always raising far too interesting questions, this Callan, right? So the point is that in general, people doing gravity don't go down in dimensions so often because if you're doing sort of free propagation of gravity, it's gravity only propagates in four dimensions or higher. And so you see this by looking at degrees of freedom of the Ricci tensor versus the Riemann tensor. So you basically count numbers of independent components. And in three dimensions, the number of independent components of Riemann and Ricci are basically the same, which means that you only get curvature or gravity when you've got a matter source, because that's what the Ricci tensor is telling you. Whereas in four dimensions, the number of degrees of freedom are different, and that's telling you that you can have a Riemann, a non-zero Riemann, with a zero Ricci, and so that's vacuum solutions. So in four dimensions, you've got two degrees of freedom. And I'll probably, if I manage to do a bit about instabilities, I'll probably say something about this. And in higher dimensions, you get more degrees of freedom. For example, in five dimensions, it's 5 degrees of freedom. And what this corresponds to is the number of degrees of freedom of a propagating field of spin 2. So three dimensions, you have to have matter to get curvature, but it doesn't mean that you don't, that it's not interesting. For example, those cosmic strings are, in some sense, sort of have a three-dimensional nature to them, i.e. 2 plus 1, and their conical deficits, a conical singularity is exactly what you get in 2 plus 1 dimensions. However, so you can't get black holes in a vacuum space because that would imply that you had some sort of gravity propagating, you know, with the vacuum. However, if you add a negative cosmological constant, then you can get something that you would interpret as a black hole. And going down even further, in two dimensions, gravity is extremely strongly pinned because all two-dimensional spaces are conformally flat. But again, if you want to add additional fields, such as the scalar field like the dilaton, then you can get some non-trivial geometry in two dimensions, but it always relies on having added extra stuff in. So in higher dimensions, you have a lot more degrees of freedom for gravity, and this starts to show up in these exotic types of solution.
I need a coffee now.